House Bill 2497. Teresa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2497 directs the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to determine compensation rates for log haulers when petitioned by a forest owner or a cooperative association. The measure establishes a process for petitioning the Commissioner, establishes items for the Commissioner to consider in determining compensation rates, and prohibits forest owner landowners from paying a compensation rate that's lower than the rates determined by the Commissioner. And this is from discriminating against any person or a cooperative association for participating in the determination rate-setting process.
Now, there's a lot of folks here, if somebody says what you were going to say, I don't care if you get up to say it again, but say it in a brief amount of time. If you have more to add, that's great, but try not to duplicate testimony if you can. I'd appreciate that. I'm going to call. Let's see. Yeah. William Holler and William Street, first of all, please. Just give them both, and then I'll go right down the line until they're done. Whenever you're ready, sir. Whenever you're ready, gentlemen.
Thank you. My name is William Street. I'm employed by the Woodworkers Department of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, and I'm a member of the Springfield, Oregon local. I would like to thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to participate in this hearing. My testimony today will focus on two items. The first item is on the price and cost of log hauling services, and the second on the consequences facing the state's woodworkers should this problem not be addressed. As part of our ongoing effort to understand the pricing mechanism of log hauling services in the Northwest, the department undertook a survey of cost and prices. We reviewed approximately 335 hauls from Oregon and Washington. We analyzed this data in terms of the size of the landowner, the cost per hour to deliver the services, and the cost per hour paid for the services. Our conclusions, which are being handed out to you now, show that for the most part, the corporate forest landowners in the state pay an average price for hauling that is below the average cost of providing the service. And in order for a driver to earn the minimum wage, the average haul would have to pay in excess of $70 an hour, and the average haul off of corporate land is approximately $52 to $53 an hour. So there is a substantial gap per hour for the driver to earn the minimum wage, and this is with the assumption that they're paying $2.75 a gallon for fuel and that they are only working a 10-hour day. What the survey also showed was that practically none of these drivers are driving a 10-hour day, and in fact, almost all of these drivers are driving more than the legal law allows. This generates a severe safety hazard because there is substantial data from the National Department of Transportation that truck safety and hours of driving are directly correlated. The other thing that was extremely odd in this process was we found that the small family and non-corporate landowners were paying about $20 an hour more for the same service than the corporate forest landowner. And this, if one is a pure economist, this of course is quite confusing because this shouldn't be able to occur. Unless the market is not operating at optimal performance, and that is our conclusion, that the large corporate landowners are capable of controlling the price, and the small farm and small forest landowners are paying a true market price. So what we see is a bifurcated market, and what this does, in essence, is create an indirect subsidy from the small landowner to the large corporate forest landowner, in the sense that many of these truckers are breaking even and making a little bit of money on their hauls for the small landowner and losing money on the hauls for the large landowner. The second point that I'd like to make is that the hauling sector has a crisis, and this crisis will affect the entire industry. Throughout the months that we have been educating members on this bill, when the Republican log truck drivers show up in a room with the Democratic Union, the most frequently asked question to the union was, why are you here? What's your horse in this race? Well, we had always maintained that if we lose the log haulers, we lose the industry, and we now have a real-world example to cite. About 3 weeks ago, about 100 trucks in the state of Washington, working under very similar conditions, individually looked at their own books and said, we cannot haul for these rates, and 135 log trucks were parked. 9 days later, the Machinist Union got a phone call from our largest single employer on the West Coast saying, we are running out of logs, we are going to have to curtail 2 logging operations, and we're looking at curtailing a mill. That's after 7 days. I would hate to think what would happen if the gentlemen in this room and in the overflow room went home tonight, looked at their books, came to the same conclusion that they were losing too much money and stopped hauling. It would have a disastrous impact on our membership. In closing, I am confident that with little or no major changes, the purported legal problems with HB 2497 can be fixed. Since, as the bill is currently written, it leaves sufficient discretion to the state agency to develop the appropriate OAR, and since it will not alter rates for the overwhelming majority of the state's forest landowners, it will affect the rates of approximately 9 to 12 landowners. I am confident not only because the supposed legal problems were anticipated when the bill was drafted, but more importantly, because as we sit here today, the state of Maine is setting log hauling rates and has been setting log hauling rates for the past 18 months. Maine sets rates for both loggers and haulers. It has an independent commission to do so. There has not been any court action. There has not been any federal preemption. Those of us here today request that you address this problem. We request that you move this bill along and grant it a work session so that it can come to the floor of the House, because we would really feel that if we wait till the next session, there will be many people in this room who won't be here. I would now like to turn the microphone over to our general counsel, who will do his own introduction.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. I was asked by Bill Street to come here. I'm on the staff of the IAM Legal Department in Washington, D.C., to address legal questions that have been raised about this bill as drafted. There have been some contentions that this is going to run afoul of federal law and be preempted. I prepared a written statement. This really gets into legal technicalities. You won't be surprised to hear that my conclusion is that, no, this bill is not going to be preempted by federal law and does not run afoul of federal law. I don't want to take much of your time, both because there are legal technicalities and because there's a lot of log haulers that want to talk to you about the real-life problems that this bill is trying to address. I'll simply just summarize what I have to say. There are basically 3 contentions that have been raised. One, that this bill would pose a conflict with federal antitrust laws. I don't think there's any real dispute about that. The Legislative Council has already concluded it wouldn't be an antitrust problem. I've attached a memo by our antitrust lawyer in Washington concluding the antitrust laws allow for state action exemption from antitrust, and this bill would not be an antitrust problem. There's also been a contention that the bill would be preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. Your legislative counsel concluded that, and that was based primarily on a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case out from 1995, Chamber of Commerce versus Bragdon. There's a couple of newer Ninth Circuit cases that I think when you look at the newer cases I cited in my memo, it's quite clear that this bill is not preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. This bill establishes essentially a procedure for establishing a minimum wage type program in the oil industry. The Ninth Circuit has expressly said that state regulatory schemes establishing minimum wages in specific industries are lawful and are not preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. Finally, in an even more complex area of law, there's a real complex bunch of laws at Title 49 United States Code that authorize the U.S. Department of Transportation to regulate motor truck carriers. It's so complicated that there's even confusion about what to call it. It's either called the Motor Carrier Act, or it's often referred to as the Federal Aviation Authorization Act, because they amended the Motor Carrier Act at some point. And you can just spend forever looking at the various provisions there. But the one that I think is pertinent and I would ask you to look at is that there's a provision in Title 49 that expressly exempts from federal regulation motor carriers who are hauling agricultural, non-manufactured agricultural commodities. And there's a federal district court case out of Louisiana that construed that specific provision that said a truck hauling logs are agricultural commodities and are not subject to federal motor carrier regulation. There's also federal regulation saying once they're sawed, they're manufactured and that's regulated by the federal government and state regulation would be preempted. But the log haulers we're talking about here, these are logs coming from the land to the mill. They're not milled yet. So we think it's quite clear it's not regulated by the federal motor carrier laws, and the state of Oregon is free to regulate in this area. We're quite confident that the bill as drafted would not be preempted by federal law. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, these gentlemen?
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31. I'm the sponsor of House Bill 2497, and appearing here today as an advocate of that bill. This bill, I think, as you've probably already heard, would establish, in essence, a prevailing wage rate for independent owner-operators who are hauling logs from the forest. The covered employers would be those that own more than 100,000 acres of forest land in Oregon. And the wage rate that would prevail, that would be established under the bill, would be set by the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I think, as you've just heard, there are some legal disputes that are surrounding this bill at this time. Mr. Chairman, as someone who's sworn to uphold both the state and federal laws of this country, I am at ease at this point until I hear differently. I've been advised by our legal counsel, legislative counsel, that at this point this bill may not be legal to proceed with. However, I have also heard from the Machinists Union that this is an evolving legal arena, and as we speak, there may be some cases that are developing around this that would suggest that in fact that it is legal to move forward, and that maybe the Federal Aviation Administration Authorization Act, which has been presumed to disallow this act, maybe in transition at this point in terms of what the legal proceedings are. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm awaiting hopefully a more favorable legal opinion. That I thank you very much for hearing this bill, and I thank you very much for providing me and the proponents and the folks that would be regulated by this bill an opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of Representative Witt? All right, thank you very much, Brad.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to call some folks of a different opinion now. And I call Greg Miller and Ralph Saperstein, please. Oh, there was. Wait a minute, Ralph. You just relax. Greg,
Lynn Cannon,
and Patty Case? Mm-hmm. Forgive me. Ralph, you can sit right there. Those three. I wish everybody would sign on one line so I didn't get confused, but that's okay. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lincoln Cannon. I represent the Oregon Forest Industries Council. OFIC is a trade association representing over 50 industrial forest landowners and forest product manufacturers in the state. OFIC members support and depend on a stable and cost-efficient base of logging and hauling contractors to support their businesses. Without them, our industry cannot function. OFIC is opposed, however, to House Bill 2497. 38% of Oregon's total land base is classified as timberland. That's over 23 million acres. Of that, 57% is owned by the federal government, 38% is privately owned, 9% is owned by state and local governments. And you have my testimony with an attachment that shows those statistics. Of the private timberland ownership, there are over 70 owners who own more than 5,000 acres, 600 owners owning between 500 and 5,000 acres, 4,000 owners owning between 100 and 500 acres of forest land, and more than 40,000 acres owners owning less than 100 acres of forest land. It's from a study done by the Department of Revenue. 80% of timber harvests in Oregon come from private lands, 10%, actually 9% from state lands, and 9% from federal timber lands. Over 18,000 notifications of operations were filed with the Department of Forestry in 2005. Serving this diverse ownership are 777 log and chip residue trucking firms running 2,600 trucks in Oregon. That's from a study done for the Department of Forestry by Paul Enger in 2005. Traditionally, the state has been involved in regulating prices only with respect to a dominant monopoly like public utilities. It seems clear to us, given the diverse ownership and harvest patterns described above, that timber hauling markets are the epitome of an open marketplace where buyers and sellers of services negotiate mutually acceptable terms in a competitive business environment. The imposition of hauling in this competitive business environment, we believe, is unwarranted. We believe this bill is bad public policy for a number of reasons. We believe it's a solution in search of a problem. This bill would set a bad precedent and encourage contractors in any other business where they felt they would like to make more to seek legislative relief from market competition. Setting rates for large landowners essentially sets floor rates for everyone else, and it raises the level and cost to all landowners. And we believe, you had discussion from one attorney, we have attorneys who have a different opinion that believe this likely violates federal antitrust laws and laws prohibiting states from regulating rates charged by motor carriers. This is almost certainly, if this bill were to pass, be in court and embroil the state in expensive litigation with a problematic outcome. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Patty Case. I work for Green Diamond Resource Company. We own and manage approximately 120,000 acres of timberland in Tillamook and Lincoln counties. You may know us as Simpson. Our name has changed, but our roots go back to 1890 in the Pacific Northwest timber industry. As you probably know, the timber industry is extremely competitive, not only within Oregon, but throughout the Northwest, and indeed throughout North America and the world. For this reason alone, state regulation of log truck hauling rates is very troubling. Our costs here in Oregon are much higher, specifically with the American South. The terrain there is much flatter, labor costs are lower, and our margins here in the Northwest are squeezed very much. Of course, Our logs don't move to market without log trucks. We're as dependent on log truck hauling as the owners of these independent companies are upon us. The key word, though, is independent. We work with several independent logging contractors, some of whom have their own trucks, some of whom contract trucking. Let me tell you just a little bit about what we do. We feel we pay a very competitive rate for trucking. That's based on hours per trip, i.e. distance and wait time, and the size of the load. Trucking is, costs are transparent in our contracts, and when the contractor's paid, the trucking is broken out in accompanying paperwork so that he can pay the truckers accordingly. This bill emphasizes safety issues. We pride ourselves on our safety ethic. Our aim is for every worker, whether our own employees or our contractors, to go home as healthy as he or she came to work each day. That philosophy is passed along to our contractors and our truckers through pre-work meetings at the beginning of each of our harvesting jobs. We also discuss fuel costs and make allowances, make adjustments when necessary at the beginning of each contract. I explain all of that to demonstrate that while we do pay competitive rates, we also consider our trucking costs in order to maintain a safe, productive, and mutually profitable relationship. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Miller. I'm the Public Affairs Manager for Weyerhaeuser Company. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon on this House Bill 2497. I do want to apologize right up front. I delivered to your office this morning a memo relating to the legal infirmities of House Bill 2497, and I transposed the numbers, so I don't hope I didn't confuse you. I said 2947. With so many bills flying around this session, it's not hard to do to get them transposed. But I guess what I'd just like to say for keeping things brief, we have owned and managed forest land in Oregon for well over 106 years. We understand the science and art of economics of managing forests in Oregon. Our contractors employed by Weyerhaeuser Company are safe, professional, and competitive. We believe it's in our best interest in the entire and in the best interest of the entire forest products industry to maintain a very healthy contract workforce. Few are more sympathetic than us to the downturns in Oregon's forest sector over the past two decades. We've all experienced the economic ebb and flow due to reductions to timber harvesting. The fact of the matter is, though, that we do not support House Bill 2947. And I did attach a very brief explanation of the legal infirmities. And just let me say, for brevity, there are two very high legal bars. First and foremost is the Federal Aviation Administration Authorization Act. And that's a federal law prohibiting states from regulating rates charged by motor carriers. It's pretty clear to us. Second is the federal antitrust law, the Sherman Antitrust Act, which also prevents states from restraining trade or limiting competition. I am not a lawyer, so I apologize for that, but if you have further legal questions, I could get those answered for you. I'd like to delve a little bit into the question around the bill. The bill writes or speaks to safety and in terms of trying to address a problem. I wanted to address that for you so that you could understand Weyerhaeuser's commitment to safety. As of today, we have placed the safety of our employees and contractors as our top priority. Our company and contract safety performance is roughly equal to a recordable incident rate of about one. Along with significant reductions to recordable incidents, the severity of these incidents have substantially reduced. We believe our safety ranks among the best in the industry. Trucking contractors have excellent safety results, with our Oregon truckers at a recordable incident rate of 0.4. Weyerhaeuser contract trucking safety is typically as good or better than our company fleet. We employ professional drivers, about 70 truck drivers represented by the IAM. There's a premise, an underlying premise in this bill about market dominance. We believe that's wrong and fundamentally flawed. Weyerhaeuser Company is the largest private landowner in the state of Oregon. All of our land is located west of the Cascades, However, Weyerhaeuser only owns about 8% of the forest land base west of the Cascades. Approximately 25% of our harvesting and hauling in Oregon is conducted by Weyerhaeuser Company employees represented by IAM. From a macro perspective, only 6% of the acres harvested in western Oregon is conducted by contractors working for Weyerhaeuser. We value our independent contractors and strive to maintain good business relationships with them. We've had very little turnover with our core group of contractors, and most have been working for us for at least 10 years. These contractors retain their independence from Weyerhaeuser by operating on other timberlands for other owners as well. The trucking workforce is equally developed and diverse, with many trucking contractors operating multiple trucks. In the Willamette Valley, as I mentioned, we operate 70 company trucks throughout the year. That equates to about 30 to 40% of our log hauling needs, depending on the busy summer season. That means that we rely on contract log haulers for the remaining 60 to 70% of our log hauling needs. We believe there's an adequate supply of log trucks in the Pacific Northwest to meet landowner and mill production needs, and Weyerhaeuser has successfully met its delivery schedules and production targets with the combination of contractor and company-owned trucks. Just to summarize for you, and I'll try to be brief here. We only own about 8% in western Oregon. We contract with just a small fraction of the total number of contract log haulers in the region. And the vast majority of contract log hauling is done by hundreds of independent mills, logging contractors, and thousands of small landowners who rely on these services. There have been some issues raised about, as you've heard in the opening testimony, I'm sure you'll hear as well further in the day, about fuel surcharges. We've addressed that head on, and we've made adjustments to our fuel surcharges over the years as fuel prices go up. We have done things like direct contracting with our contract haulers. So they prefer to be contracted with directly as opposed to contracting with the logger. So we engage in that practice here in the Willamette Valley. We have a single point of contact up in Washington, and we certainly would be willing to establish a single point of contact here in the Willamette Valley as well. And I'd also like to point out that during the day when the trucks are at the landing for loading and unloading policies, we've recognized that the contractors need to get a full day's worth of work in order to remain competitive. So we have done things in our practices, for example, to rotate our trucks through the string so that all of our drivers, including contract and company drivers, get an equal shot at the loads per day. That's a business practice that we use here in Oregon, exclusive. The other thing is to ensure loading times are equal at the mill site. Unloading times at the mills has improved, but we've established some GPS units in our company trucks to determine, better understand what the wait times and where those are occurring. Just as a wrap up, as a matter of real policy, we have serious reservations about negotiating set overall market rates. We think the rates need to reflect the species grade, topography, and distance to market, distance to paved roads, road conditions, and time of the year that the harvest will occur. With that, I'll end my testimony and thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. Any questions to this panel? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to call a couple of proponents of the bill, then I'm going to bring the industry back up here, then I'm going to end with some proponents. Debbie Williams and Jim Benson, please. And whenever you're ready, just go to it.
Oh, my goodness. Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you. I want to thank you for letting me speak this afternoon. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2497. On behalf of myself, 2,000 log truck drivers and thousands of woodworkers and rural Oregonians who depend on log truck drivers for their jobs.
Ma'am, I don't know if you did or not, but you got to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's quite right. You're doing great.
I'm Debbie Williams.
Thank you.
Okay. As a wife of a log truck driver testifying for this legislation, I would like to point out a few things that some of these drivers may not, and they may, but anyway. All the log truck drivers, witnesses that you will hear from today, are volunteers. They have used their own money to come here. No one has paid for their time, their gas, or reimbursed them for the $300 to $600 they may have lost by stopping to work early to come here today. When you hear from the professional lobbyists and corporate executives who will testify against both the bill and against the interests of these log truck drivers, please keep this distinction in mind. Our opponents will tell you there's no shortage of log trucks. They will tell you they have listened to the log truckers and do not see a problem. And they will tell you there are many legal problems facing our legislation. In every instance, they are paid to say these things. These log truck drivers have not been paid to be here. They are here to speak and show their support for House Bill 2497.
Doing great.
I'm sorry.
We're just regular folks, Jim.
I know that.
I didn't always wear a monkey suit like this.
Oh, goodness. Our opponents will say they have solved this problem by giving the contractors a full day's work. The driver will tell you they've already been working more hours than the law allows. Our opponents will say they have listened to the concerns of the drivers and responded. The drivers will say they cannot pay health insurance with words. They need money for that. Our opponents will tell you there's no truck shortage. These drivers will tell you they're called on Saturdays and Sundays to work because there's not enough trucks. Our opponents will tell you that our legislation is too expensive. Our opponents will say there are legal issues. Yet the state of Maine enacted a similar legislation 2 years ago. Likewise, the state of Oregon has already passed legislation permitting crabbers and grass seed growers to bargain with processing plants, very similar to our legislation. The legal issues exist in the minds of the opponents and their paid attorneys. For every issue presented as a legal problem was raised by the same interest groups two decades ago when Oregon became one of the first states in the nation to pass plant closure notification. Oregon did not enact the land use planning, the bottle bill, or physician-assisted suicide by refusing to challenge a law interpreted by those who lack visions to see alternatives. The court, on the other hand, has ruled consistently that states can regulate markets if they have a state policy, forgive me for reading this, I'm trying to remember it, and are actively engaged in enforcement. State can set wages. There is no antitrust liability for the state of Oregon in passing this legislation. The opposition cannot provide court cases when federal judges have reached out and prevented states who have a policy and who monitor it from promoting the public wealth. When those in favor of this legislation have completed the testimony, you will have heard and seen from numerous log truck drivers representing more. When our opponents have completed testifying, you will have heard from a handful of paid professionals representing other paid professionals. Your choice is a simple one. Who do you believe? Do you believe the folks who are losing money to be here, or do you believe those who are paid more for attending this meeting than these truckers sometimes make in a month? We have spent the last 3 years trying to avoid legislation. We have met with the companies trying to work this out. We have asked for a summit meeting with large landowners to bring the problems to our table. Our opponent's reply was, "You are not going to tell us what it costs to run a log truck, and next time you will hear from us when we testify against you in a hearing." Lastly, the issue of log truck safety is being widely discussed in the Northwest. There are numbers of bills to increase regulation and increase the cost of truckers. Let me say what truckers may not say. Until you address the root cause of truck safety, none of these other actions will solve the problem. The root cause of truckers' compensation is presented as take it or leave it. It is so low that they must drive more hours than the law allows. They must drive faster than the speed limit, and they must carry heavier loads than permitted. They either do this or go bankrupt. Until you put more money into the log truckers' pocket, skilled drivers will continue to leave the sector. New trucks will not be put into service, and the public will continue to be at risk. Please do not interpret this as a threat. It's not. It's economic reality. In conclusion, please listen carefully to what is said this afternoon. Those in support of this legislation are speaking from their heart with the future of their families and their jobs on the line. Those in opposition to this bill cannot honestly make that claim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman and Committee, for allowing me to be here today and speak. My name is James Benson. I'm from Astoria, Oregon. I'm a second-generation log trucker. My company is J.C. Benson II, Inc., and I'm a member of the Northwest Log Truckers Co-op. I'm here to support House Bill 2497. I've been involved in log trucking since 1976 and in business for myself since 1980. I'm a multi-truck operator running as many as 12 log trucks and currently operating 5 log trucks and a dump truck. Mr. Chairman, we're here today because our sector, the independent log trucker, is in crisis and on the verge of collapse. Despite everything we do, we're still going broke. All my trucks are paid for. My last purchase was a 2001 model, which coincidentally is about the time Weyerhaeuser took over the timber industry in our area. I talked to many owner-operators that say if they had a truck payment, they couldn't make it. And it doesn't even need to be a new truck, just an upgrade. I've done everything possible to be successful and profitable. I drive, work in the shop, and I do all the office and paperwork. My company does 99% of our tire work on-site at our shop. When I first started hauling logs, the loading didn't start till daylight. Then somebody got the bright idea to put lights on a log loader. I now have drivers in this room today that get up at 1:30 in the morning and may not get home till after 5 o'clock at night. And tonight it'll be even later. What has this extra effort got us? It's got us reduced rates. I've actually returned to jobs where we've hauled in previous years and been paid less the second time than we were when we hauled there the first time. While rates remain flat or even decline, our costs skyrocket. In 1972, the shop rate at Roberts Motor Company in Portland, Oregon, repair rate was $12 an hour. Today, the rate's $95 an hour. In 1977, I was working for my dad. We purchased a new log truck for $56,000. Fuel then was less than 40 cents a gallon, and we made about $40 an hour. Today, that same truck costs $145,000. Fuel is $2.50 a gallon, plus or minus, and some timber companies want to pay us $50 to $55 an hour. Though the law claims we're independent business owners, the big timber companies treat us like employees. They set the log hauling rates with their contract loggers without any input from the log trucker. Earlier today mentioned negotiation. We don't get to negotiate our haul rates. Some tell us we have to be their security team by unlocking and locking the gates as we enter and exit their property. Every time you start and stop a truck, it costs money. They haven't given us any more money for being their security team. They tell us how to drive, even what to wear, and they half-heartedly try to inspect our equipment. The Weyerhaeuser company claims to be a safety-conscious company, and in their safe working practices for trucking brochure, one statement is, maintain your equipment and only operate a well-maintained truck. Are they kidding? They barely pay us enough to adequately maintain our equipment and nothing to put towards replacement of the equipment. They don't build their logging roads to stand up to the pounding the logging equipment and the trucks exert on them, and therefore it's even harder on our equipment. When drivers drive faster off-road to make sure they get their trips in, it's damaging to the truck and puts the public at risk when the truck hits the highway after being abused off-road. If we are independent businesses, then why don't we decide how much to bill the companies and not them tell us what we pay? You don't walk into a restaurant and tell them what you're going to pay them for a cheeseburger. In approximately May of 2006, I was hauling for two different loggers working for Weyerhaeuser. Weyerhaeuser was aligned approximately 30 cents per mile as a fuel surcharge. One logger paid us a flat rate, the number of miles, round trip, times 30 cents. Pretty simple to figure. The other logger incorporated the fuel surcharge into the haul rate. Now, since each load pays a little different, weight, scale, whatever, that means the fuel surcharge was different every trip. Well, you're traveling the same miles to the same destination from the same job. I've had loads from the same job to the same destination pay $50 to $100 difference because some pay by weight, some pay by scale, and some pay by a measurement Weyerhaeuser calls the Q-net. In an effort to get an answer to the fuel surcharge being incorporated in the haul rates and other questions, I contacted Weyerhaeuser North Coast directly. Their response was that since I didn't have a contract with Weyerhaeuser, they had no interest in talking to me. The contract supervisor stated he didn't care whether the logger paid the fuel surcharge to the truckers or not. When the Northwest Log Truckers Co-op mentioned this conversation to a Weyerhaeuser upper management, it got back to the North Coast Tree Farm, and my trucks were temporarily blackballed from hauling there. This cost me my number one seniority driver who had been with me for 11 years. During the first 7 months of 2006, I had 100% turnover in my drivers. Of these, only two took jobs driving log trucks. The others left the industry. I used to provide medical, dental, vision, a 401, a vision insurance, a 401k plan, and I gave a birthday bonus. I've had to drop all these benefits because the expenses have increased and the haul rates haven't kept up. I'm now lucky to break even. This is not unique to me. As a result, we are running out of trained and experienced drivers. People ask me, why do you stay in the industry? Well, when I first started, I liked the work and the money was good. Now, 30 years later, I've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to build a company to as many as 12 trucks. My equipment is specialized. Log trucks are designed to haul log trucks. We can't just hook onto a belly dump, a flatbed, a low boy, or a reefer van and haul something else. That's part of the problem. The timber companies know we're specialized. In concluding, I would like to make this point. The log trucking industry has a problem regarding adequate compensation. We need more money. If all of us here supporting this bill today were to leave the industry, the problem would not go away. Mills would experience log shortages and have to shut down, as previously mentioned today. This situation must be altered, and it cannot wait for the next session of the legislature. By then, it will be too late, and many of us will be gone. In my opinion, if you fail to support this bill, you're supporting Big Timber and corporate America, not the people of the state of Oregon. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions of these folks? All right. Thank you very much. Ralph Saperstein, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Ralph Saperstein. I guess I'm one of those corporate lobbyists that was not so favorably referred to previously. Something about if it looks like a duck, I may look like a corporate lobbyist, but there's actually more to me than that. And I'm here today representing folks, including Boise Cascade. Boise Cascade has 2,500 employees throughout Oregon. Boise has 15 wood products plants that need log trucks to keep them supplied. Also, I'm representing a place where I got my start in the forest industry, a local regional trade association called Douglas Timber Operators out of Roseburg, Oregon. DTO has over 140 members. And these are not corporate members. There are some, but most of them are independent family-owned companies ranging in size from Roseburg Forest Products with over 3,500 employees to small log trucking companies with three log trucks. And I tell you what the name of it is, but you told me to turn off my cell phone, and so I can't look again to see what the name was. And these folks are not corporate. They're independent family-owned companies. And one of them specifically is Charles Ireland Trucking. And Charles Ireland Trucking is a small trucking firm out of Myrtle Creek that is currently run by Charlie Ireland. Well, they're laughing because it's small. It's 120. They have approximately 120 trucks. But Charlie Ireland is Charlie Ireland III. It was started in 1940, and they've been operating for 57 years. Charlie Ireland IV now works for them and will soon probably run the company. But all of these independent family-owned companies oppose 2497. As somebody stated, the log trucking industry is really quintessential free market. And because you need a log truck to enter the industry, there's no bars on entering the log trucking industry. The state setting rates on log trucking will change the free market system that currently exists to a more socially driven system. And not only do we support what's been said about the legality, but this is a whole different doctrine that we would manage on. And the timber industry has historically been, as I said before, quintessentially the most free market system, because it doesn't take much to enter the industry. By having the public set, or the state set rates for log trucking, that would change the whole nature of the timber industry. No longer would it be independent and run by people trying to make a profit. It would be government standards that control the timber industry. All of my clients that I mentioned, the small family-owned companies, they all support a free market to keep the timber industry competitive. They think that's what provides Oregon the best in terms of environmental protection and family wage jobs and stability. I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee has.
Any questions? All right. Representative Holden.
Well, you just talked about something. I guess I just have to ask about your free market analysis there, that free market is going to take care of everything and provide good living wage jobs and safety and environmental protections and everything else. And my idea of
I'm not saying everything else, but that's a good basis. Sometimes you need regulation to come in to play also, like for environmental.
Ralph, you want to let him finish his question?
Oh,
thanks.
Go ahead, Representative.
Evidently doesn't, so...
Go ahead, Representative.
Well, I
want to hear what you have to say.
I just wonder, you know, how with this free market, you know, we would have competition setting everything, and how are we going to make sure that safety's taken care of and people are paid a living wage if the bid goes out to the lowest bidder every time? It seems like that would be a good incentive to cut corners and a good incentive to pay people less. So I guess, you know, your free market approach doesn't make sense to me in the terms of this discussion. So I'm wondering how you think that the free market in the log truck industry or driving industry is going to help provide the living wage jobs and the safety on the road and making sure the equipment is maintained properly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Holby. Excuse me. The safety, and that's something that I think the free market is dealing with, because for most companies I've been aware of, including Boise, and we heard earlier that safety is the most important issue, and there's nothing more important than safety. So the reason why it is because those free market companies have made the decision that safety is number one. And it's not because a government agency told them that. It's that is the value that they have set for their company. And so I think this is a great example that shows the free market does work, because these independent companies have decided that safety is the number one value, and nothing is more important than safety. And your second part was?
Living wages.
That's all right, Mr. Chair. I don't need an answer.
All right. I guess any more questions of Ralph Sapperstein today? Thank you, sir. Thanks for coming. All right. I'm going to finish with two proponents of the bill, Dennis Woodward and R.C. Wedner, please. Whenever you're ready, gentlemen.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Woodward. I'm with the Northwest Log Truckers Co-op, but more importantly, I've been a log hauler for 17 years in the state of Oregon. And I would like to thank the committee for your time and ask for your support on House Bill 2497. When I started hauling logs in 1989, prices were... for tires were around $200. Fuel was 75 to 80 cents a gallon. A new truck was about $75,000. And family insurance can cost you about $450. Today, the costs have more than doubled. Tires over $400. Fuel at $260 to $3, depending on where you're at. And a new truck at $126,000. Your family insurance now is $850 to $1,000 a month. Hauling prices for log trucking today are approximately within 10% of what they were in 1989. Today's log haulers are working longer hours, hauling dangerously heavy loads to try and keep pace with the cost, and can no longer even afford the basic health insurance for their families. Cutting corners on safety is a common practice to be able to afford to feed our families. When operators dangerously overload poorly maintained trucks and use public highways, all Oregonians are in imminent danger. The cost beyond safety is millions of dollars leaving Oregon to other parts of the country, robbing our local communities of much needed dollars that should be supporting our local schools, municipal governments, and this must be stopped. Our local businesses suffer from these lack of Oregon timber dollars. Rural residents are forced to shop at large, urban-based, big-box retail stores rather than being able to buy from their local merchants. And I think that Oregon timber dollars, rural Oregon timber dollars, should be spent in rural Oregon first. It's the only way that we're going to keep that viable part of Oregon's economy and stay strong. Log truckers today have no voice in haul rates. The timber companies post prices that vary from low to lower. Log haulers can either haul for that price or stay home. To work for another timber company will only mean the same deal, just a different place. We are paid on many of our hauls by volume of our loads. In some cases, We will be hauling a volume that nets an acceptable pay, and the timber company, by size of log, decide to reduce the volume of our loads, resulting in lower pay. Just 2 weeks ago, such an incident happened that cost me around $50 to $60 per load, with no advance warning, no ability to negotiate that rate. And since they don't accept billings for my cost, and they decide what will be paid, we're unaware of this price drop until our paycheck arrives. And this particular incident cost my business and my family $150 to $180 a day. And I could conclude with saying, yes, I could quit and move on, and really I do plan on doing so, because we can't even get a fair shake. However, timber and logging should always continue to be a vital part of Oregon's economy. And just because I leave doesn't mean the problem will go away. In fact, if I and others in this room leave the business, the problem will get worse. New drivers are not coming into the industry. Those who do enter come without any training. If the situation looks bad today, if nothing is done, it will be worse tomorrow. And I believe that Oregon doesn't need more problems or bigger problems. We need solutions to build Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name's R.C. Wedner, and I also am part of the Northwest Co-op. And I guess I might be your first speaker shooting from the hip here, because I didn't write a speech. But I would like to state that what this was is a testimony, and a testimony is where you tell your story. But I don't want to tell you the whole story. I'm going to try and be brief. But in 1998, after having been in the timber industry in and out of it since 1975, I was working for a company that basically closed down. And so my dream had always been to buy a log truck. And I got a permit. I called up to order the permit, and the first thing she says, "Oh, you want a dump truck permit?" And I said, "No, I want a log truck permit." She went silent. And that should have been my first clue. But I got it anyway, because I thought to myself, I said, my dream has been to get my own log truck, not my own dump truck. Well, after about 5 or 6 more years, I'm pulling a dump truck. I couldn't do it. I spent my whole life training myself to do my job. I felt very good at it. My truck maybe went in the shop once a year, and I bought a truck with 1.6 million miles on it. You put a truck together with 1.6 million miles, make it show up every day, 14 hours a day. Don't tell me you don't know what you're doing. So don't tell me I'm not qualified for my job. Okay? I have an accident record that I'll put up against anybody's. I didn't wreck trucks. I bought that truck with a loan I borrowed on my house that I happened to make a good purchase on. I kept it for 3 years. I got a little bit tired of working every weekend. And no, I did not log those weekends. I work Saturday. I work Sunday. My kids paid for that. Now, you might ask, why didn't you get out? Well, I am out. I'm the guy who got out. Why am I here? Because I feel a moral responsibility. I believe that the state of Oregon has got a moral responsibility. I believe I'm here for the same reason you're here. Because you feel a moral responsibility to your communities. That's why you're here. That's why I'm here. Because I never paid any income taxes the entire time I owned a log truck. The last 2 years that I've been out, I now have an income tax problem, believe it or not. Okay? I believe that we have a moral obligation. That's why I'm still here fighting for this situation, this House bill. I don't know if the House bill is right, wrong. There's legal people going to stand here and argue that. I'm not here for that reason. I'm here to tell you we got a problem. My family's been in the timber industry. My brother-in-law is in the timber industry. His brother's in the timber industry. He's now in state government, county government, because he couldn't make it either. You've got a problem. We've got a problem. That's all we're asking to do. Take a look at the problem. See if you can't work out a solution. We're just trying. And I mean, a lot of people are going to speak today and already have spoken about the problem. But I'm telling you, I even put my wife in the log truck. I couldn't work the hours. I was on the North Coast with Jim Benson. I had so many hours, I couldn't even do them. Forget the logbook. I put my wife, we drove past my house on the way to the last mill. I live in the valley. The last load went to Springfield, Oregon off the North Coast. I was averaging just short of 500 miles a day on secondary. My wife delivered the last load one day a week so I could take a nap, because I was beat. she's sitting out in the overflow. Okay? Now, I'm telling you, you got a problem. And people make big money going to sit here and say you don't have a problem. All I'm asking, put one of them in my truck for one day doing that job. And then they get at the end of the day asking if we got a problem. We got a problem. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions of these gentlemen? Well, thanks for coming today. I hope any industry is listening. If there is a problem and it's growing, they can be their best friends by doing something about it. There's a lot of legal beagle stuff going on here that I'm not going to even attempt to try to explain to you. This is the first public hearing of this bill. I'm not promising you anything's going to happen this session. I'm not going to do that. I'd be lying to you. But I think we do need to continue to take a good close look at this. I ain't going to argue with you. But I hope y'all can figure something out with these folks. And for the life of me, I don't know when this, you're not going to like hearing this. If you ain't making a living, I don't know why you're doing it. I know it's a way of life, and God bless you. I'm a firm, staunch supporter of the timber industry in this state, which includes you guys and gals. But I guess I'm just going to shut up before I get myself in more trouble.
Thank you for coming.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you about to close this hearing?
Yes, ma'am.
May I speak?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, these folks came into my office early on in this process, and I was shocked to see them in my office. I'm a Republican pro-business, and they are part of Oregon's history, independent truckers. I mean, they've rolled by me my entire life, and I was shocked that they were coming in saying, we want some sort of price control. I said, you're independent truckers. You're independent. What are you doing in here? Subsequently, I thought, well, maybe this is just a small subset. I've come to see that there's a lot of you, and this is a significant issue. I note from Mr. Cannon's testimony, he has four things in here. The bill sets a bad precedent, that rates for large landowners aren't fair, and the legislation violates antitrust laws. And all of this may be true, but his first thing was the bill is a solution in search of a problem. I would say to the industry that I think we do have a problem. And it's backed up by the fact that I got a call from a local insurance agent, a very conservative, pro-business constituent of mine, who said, what's going on with the log truck haulers? I wrote a whole bunch of policies, then I had to cancel them, and then when they got a new job, I had to sign them up again. So I would say to the industry and the folks in here, whether this bill goes forward or not, that I do believe we have a problem, and I think that we need to start working on it, because if this problem shuts down this industry, we are all going to have a problem. So thank you for the testimony, and I hope that calm and cool and people who want to work together come together and something happens here.
Thank you, Representative. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2497. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3357. Teresa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, House Bill 3357 modifies the conditions under which an injured state worker may lose reinstatement and reemployment rights. You have in your bill packets today a -1 amendment which replaces the bill, and the amendment has been approved by the Management Labor Advisory Committee. The amendment clarifies in current statute that agencies must adopt by rule the process.
Could you take your conversations outside, please? Appreciate it very much. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The agencies must, by rule, adopt a process to identify light entry-level and light-duty assignments for injured state workers. It also establishes the Task Force on Injured Workers, whose focus is on reviewing state policies relating to an injured worker's return to work by reinstatement or reemployment. There's an emergency clause on the amendment.
Looks like we have a couple of people. It's David Schatz and Mary Botkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin, and I'm going to be very brief today because with me I have Mr. Dave Schatz, who is one of our members from Eastern Oregon. He is currently working at the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institute, and we hope that he will be soon working at Two Rivers, but regardless. Let me just talk to you a little bit about the purpose of the bill generally and why we had it introduced. In the early 90s, Oregon enacted a series of workers' comp reforms, and encapsulated in those reforms was a provision that made the state of Oregon a single employer, so all of its agencies and all of its little subsets of the state would be considered one employer for the purposes of setting workers' comp rates. As a result, the state of Oregon's workers' comp rates were drastically reduced, and millions of dollars have been saved over the years. We supported those reforms, and it was our understanding and our belief that when we established the provision that made the state one employer, that the state would also be one employer for the purposes of returning to work injured workers. Up until that time, we had experienced a lot of problems getting our folks back to work after an injury. It is now 2007, and we still have a problem getting state employees back to work after an injury. Now, Dave's going to tell you his story, and I'm going to sort of talk about what the bill does now. The bill makes some of those very simple little changes. It changes the word, the term shall to may. I mean, from the term may to shall in a couple of different places in the bill. It says that the state of Oregon shall return their injured. They shall find people a job. They shall force other agencies to help find jobs for injured workers. Now, in some cases, injured workers can't return to work to their former employer, to their former agency. And Dave will talk a little bit about the Department of Corrections. I can tell you that the only cases that ever come to my desk are the worst, the most egregious, the most horrific. Earlier in the session, you all heard testimony about the officer that had severe head injuries after being beaten with a weight bar by an inmate, which subsequently eliminated the use of free weights in the institutions. That officer faced a lot of the same problems that Mr. Schatz has faced, and that officer was eventually terminated. Instead of finding him another job in another agency somewhere in state government, the state just simply terminated him. This is not what we expect of our state government. Now, the bill will require that DAS, in my opinion, do its job. It also sets up a task force, which allows us to walk through the process to identify barriers that the state says they have that we have not been able to identify yet. The task force lasts through to the next session. The task force would be able to make recommendations to next session of the legislature for any legal changes that need to be made, any statutory changes that need to be made in the law in order to provide a more smooth operation to get folks back to work. Let me just emphasize that AFSCME Council 75 has only one goal with this bill. We want our members to find a job when they've been injured. We think that state government, as the largest employer in Oregon, ought to be able to find these workers a job somewhere within within the parameters of state government. And we think that with some retraining provisions under preferred worker programs, that should not be an insurmountable task. It seems to be an insurmountable task, which is why you have a bill in front of you. And with that, I want Dave to talk a little bit about what happened to him. This bill does not solve all the problems that have risen to our attention in Dave's case, but it sets up a process that we think will allow us to solve those problems over a period of time. And we think it will stop it from happening again, and it puts the state on notice that we expect DAS to do the same thing every other employer in the state of Oregon has to do, and that is take responsibility for your injured workers. It's your job. Thank you.
Sir, go ahead.
Chair Schaffler, committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Briefly, my name is Dave Schatz, for the record, and in May of 1998, I was hired as a correctional officer with Department of Corrections out at EOCI in Pendleton. And in April of 2001, while I was assigned to the Disciplinary Segregation Unit, participated in a cell extraction, which is a forced removal of an inmate from a cell in the DSU unit. And as part of the extraction team, we went into the cell. The inmate had flooded out his cell. I ended up slipping and hitting my knee against a stainless steel toilet, which resulted in a fractured bone in my knee joint, torn ligament, torn cartilage. Within a month after that, I had my first surgery to repair the damage. By August of that same year, I returned to work unrestricted as an officer assigned to the DSU unit. In November of 2001, during a fight in our West dining room, approximately 300 inmates present, I ended up assisting in a takedown of two combative inmates and ended up re-breaking the same knee and tearing more cartilage, tearing a ligament. In December of that same year, I had my second reconstructive surgery. In February 2002, returned to work unrestricted and continued in that capacity until roughly June of 2002, where I felt in the knee, and my doctors felt that my knee was not coming around the way it should. It was still giving me several problems. I had a third surgery, which was called a high tibial osteotomy, where they took a chunk of wedge of bone out of my lower leg bone and realigned the lower leg bone with the use of plates and screws to take pressure off the anterior fracture site. In September of 2002, after that surgery, I returned to work unrestricted. In December of 2003, under advice of a third opinion, third doctor, I had a fourth surgery to remove bone chips and cartilage, torn meniscus, caused by general wear and tear of correctional officer work, and so on and so forth. He also removed the plates and screws, which were potentially causing some of the issues, some of the problems. And in January of that same year, I developed a real nice staph infection in a couple of the surgical sites, which required a hospitalization and approximately 2 months of IV therapy. Healed up, I returned to work unrestricted in March of 2003. In September, early October 2004, during a routine pat-down search of an inmate, I ended up twisting wrong and dislocating my knee joint and ended up having my kneecap floating around on the interior portion of my knee. And in November of that same year, I ended up having an additional reconstructive surgery to place screws in the kneecap to prevent it from moving around, and they did a bone graft procedure to strengthen the osteotomy site. In January of 2005, I returned to work unrestricted. In July of 2005, we had a disturbance in our DSU unit, which resulted in 69 forced cell extractions. I participated in 18 of the cell extractions. It's on my last one where, once again, I ended up tearing a ligament and tearing meniscus in the same knee. In October of that year, the same year, a knee was you know, not coming around like I thought it would, like my doctors had hoped it would. He took me off of officer status at that time and was put on light duty. And an MRI revealed more damage to the meniscus and the cartilage. The doctor restricted me from having inmate contact. In November of 2005, I had my sixth and final surgery to repair meniscus and cartilage damage in the knee. In December of 2005, I was informed by a payroll manager that since I had been off of work for 90 days, since October, since the doctor placed me on light duty, that my health insurance was being canceled. In January 2006, my attending doctor and surgeon, Dr. Robert Zersky, stated that he would not release me to work unrestricted any longer as an officer within the Department of Corrections. I talked to the safety manager at EOCI about transferring into another position, and she began the process of notifying Department of Administrative Services, Risk Management, and Human Resources. In January and February, early part of February 2006, I met with a SAFE representative regarding vocational retraining. And Mr. Gailey told me that because of my educational background, where I do have a college degree, and with a lot of years of law enforcement experience, I'm also a reserve deputy sheriff for the Umatilla County Sheriff's Office and have been since 2000. He said that I would not, and because I do qualify for or meet the minimum qualifications for several open positions that are not officers, that I was ineligible for vocational assistance and vocational retraining. In March of 2006, I received a letter in the mail saying that I was being terminated from my officer position with the Oregon Department of Corrections because I could not return due to my injuries. At that time, my life just basically, you know, came to a standstill. And as a result of that, I was just a real joyous individual to be around. It has since cost me my marriage and my home. I have since returned to work with the Department of Corrections through the good graces of quite a few people involved. But I returned as an office specialist in the superintendent's office at roughly $700 less a month than what I was making as an officer. Each of my injuries, unfortunately, were separate individual injuries caused by incidents, caused by different incidents within the prisons, and different inmates. But SAFE has classified them as re-aggravations of the existing injury, hence no other claims were opened. SAFE calculated my compensation each and every time I was on light duty or restricted duty based on my 2001 wage, which was roughly $1,000 less a month than what I was making in 2006. I urge you to support House Bill 3357 because this theoretically shouldn't have happened. I don't think there's anyone that can justify terminating a worker that was injured on the job. I don't want to see it happen to anyone in the future. There are roughly 3,000 state correctional employees in the state of Oregon. That doesn't count any of the county, local, and federal correctional officers. And frankly, it won't help me now. I'm still waiting a little less patiently every day to have the wrongs corrected while people in their organizations keep pointing fingers and avoiding the accountability. Each of the inmates who have injured me or who were involved in the incidents in which I sustained injuries are now out with free and new opportunities. After nearly 10 years of service and enduring 6 surgeries due to the injuries caused by individual inmate encounters, I'm making far less than what I was, and unfortunately I can't sustain, I can't support myself and my children. Like I said, I am in the process of divorcing and will lose my house because of it. And I've, you know, come really close to losing faith in the process that I thought would have protected me. I'm waiting for a new opportunity, and I'm doing everything I can to get into newer, higher paying positions that better utilize my skills. I support House Bill 3357 and continue and will continue to do so. And once again, I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. I hope you get squared away, believe me. This has all been through the MLAC process, Mary. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We've gone to MLAC, and we've talked with the Department of Labor, who will be, does the 659 change rather than a workers' comp change? But both processes, or both agencies have said they're fine with the bill, the
Thank
way
you.
It's been changed. And I do want to say that we are working diligently on finding Mr. Schatz more suitable employment economically within the Department of Corrections.
Thank you very much. Any questions of these folks? Representative Byrd.
No question, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I happen to know of Mr. Schatz, and I can verify everything he told about this horrific story. I've heard it before, and it's just a really egregious example of something that shouldn't happen. And this bill, it looks to me, is a step in the real right direction towards trying to prevent this kind of thing in the future. And in the meantime, I certainly hope that the agency will find a good solution for Mr. Schatz. This shouldn't have happened.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I can't believe that we're here discussing this. You have 50,000 workers and slots to fill, and we can't find one for an injured worker that was injured on the job. This, to me, is completely unacceptable, and I hope DAS is listening very closely. This type of behavior toward people is unbelievable. We're supposed to be the leaders in this state, and yet we have a double standard. And I'll be honest with you, Mr. Chair, it angered me very much that we're even discussing this. In the private sector, I know when we had 350 and 400 employees, when we'd get an injured individual, due to an on-the-job injury, we'd take care of that individual because he was one of us. I can't believe we don't do that in the state. We'll just leave it at that.
And at the risk of causing a lot of trouble, I'm going to remind everybody these very same people want the ability to negotiate for safety and staffing on the job. I just thought I'd put that in there, too. Any further questions of these nice people? Very good. First public hearing of this bill today. Would anybody else like to testify to it? If not, close the bill. Public hearing, House Bill 3357. Open a work session, House Bill 2783.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Good luck to you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2783 requires a workers' compensation insurer to provide the notice of termination of coverage 45 days prior to the effective date of termination. We first read this bill on April 6th. You have in front of you a -2 amendment that establishes if the termination of a guarantee contract is due to nonpayment, the termination is effective no sooner than 10 days after the notice has been mailed to the employer.
Thank you. This bill has been through MLAC and
everything
too, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Does anybody have any questions on this bill? Because I just want to work it today and keep it moving on. Representative Wolby?
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2783.
Representative Wolby moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2783. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I don't have the -2 amendments. And there, thank you. I have the -2. Okay, now I can vote them. I got them in my head.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Wolby.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2783 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves House Bill 2783 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any questions or any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Shields Bill.
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. This is Representative Shields' bill. I'd imagine he'd like to carry it on the floor. If not, I will. So we'll sign it to Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Escobar.
Three of us are on this bill,
ma'am,
as well. So you don't feel compelled to do it, is what I'm saying.
He's been working this He came to me at the beginning of the session. If he says no, then I'll come straight to you.
No. I was going to volunteer Representative Holder.
Oh, okay. Well, then we'll go straight there. We'll close the work session of Hospital 2783 and we'll open a work session of Hospital 3339.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3339 modifies the conditions under which an individual may be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits when they become unemployed due to a lockout resulting from a labor dispute. We first heard this measure on April the 4th, and to best my knowledge, there's no amendment in front of you. Well, someone brings one up.
All right. I have Mr. Smith here from the Longshoremen Union. I think you may have a couple words you wanted to add to this, Jeff. Is that or not?
I'm not prepared today, Representative.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to give you the opportunity because you were here.
I guess if I said anything, I just, you know.
Oh, if you're going to say anything, you got to come up and introduce yourself. Because I know there was a long conversation, and we concentrated on grocery stores rather than longshoremen, and if you wanted to add anything to that, now's your chance.
Representative Shuffler, committee members, thank you.
Identify yourself, please.
Jeff Smith, President, Local 8, ILWU, Portland. The biggest thing that we want to make sure that we let everybody understand is when the employers lock you out, you know, you're standing there with your lunchbox and your hard hat and your gloves and your boots, and you're ready to go to work, and they lock you out. And that was the purpose of this bill. It just makes sense. They're locking us out, and we're ready and willing to go to work, and during a lockout like that, we can't go find other work because we have to be on that picket line and so forth. So.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it. I'll entertain a motion on this bill. Representative Esquivel.
That's what I'd like to ask. I'm sorry he got away from me.
If you would like Mr. Smith to answer a question, I'm sure he'd be willing to accommodate you.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Smith, I'm sorry that you got away from me there. Chair Shoffer.
I'm just as nervous as the lady in blue was. So.
You should be. No, I'm nervous longshoremen. I didn't think they existed.
multi-bargaining situation. It's come to my understanding, and I'd like you to correct this if this is wrong, multi-employer bargaining unit, that through a general consensus of not only the employees but the employers, that they negotiate on a regional basis between one, two, and sometimes even three organizations, which should be separate companies. Anyone associated with the union agrees during that process for negotiations. And what this is, it has to do with something with one of them dropping out or going on strike, so there's a lockout on the remaining three because they have an intertie with this regionalization, and I call it a regionalization. I don't know what else you could call it. Is that true?
Representative Shoffler, committee member Esquivel. You know, that's a grocery workers question, I guess you might say.
And have Ms. Courchois on the back, but I'm just going to, if there's Freddy's, Albertson's, and Safeway, the union, workers at Freddy's vote to go out on strike. Their union brothers and sisters in the union support that strike, but there's individual contracts which eat with each one of those companies. So the union supports the brothers and sisters in the union on their strike in Freddy's, but Safeway and Albertsons, arbitrarily in my opinion, lock them out too. That's what's going on here.
Chairman Shuffler and committee members, I believe that's true. And
Kishwa, is that accurate? Would you come up here and add something to this?
I believe I just read something today's Oregonian that in Southern California, that this is what's happening with the grocery workers in Southern California. One company is voted for a strike authorization. If that store or that company goes on strike, the other two will be locked out.
The workers
will be locked
out. Ms. Kushwa, you want to identify yourself and just shed a little light on that question?
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Kushwa for the UFCW. And thank you, Chair Shoffler, Representative Esquivel. I think where the delineation came, and I had this conversation with Representative Berger as well, is that when the union votes to strike, they vote to authorize a strike. So even though they're one union, they're operating under three separate contracts, they vote to authorize a strike at one company. Then there's a second decision. That second decision is each worker who works for that company chooses whether or not to go on strike or to go to work. if the other companies lock out those workers do not have that choice about whether they get to go to work or not. They don't have a choice. And the problem is the striking workers don't get unemployment insurance. That makes sense. The locked out workers who want to go to work don't get unemployment insurance. You know, they've got the short end of the stick both ways.
Mm-hmm. Representative Berger.
Ms.
Kushwa.
Kushwa. But it is true they have voted a positive vote strike, and it is also true that all of the contracts are identical.
It is true that they have voted to authorize a strike. They've not all voted to go on strike. They voted to authorize a strike for whatever the one store is for those workers, for whatever reasons that particular entity has. And with the exception of some stores in Portland, everywhere else in the state, they're separate contracts with the same terms.
They are separate contracts with exactly the same terms.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
May I add one more thing?
Yes, please.
30 other states do not prohibit locked out workers from receiving unemployment insurance.
30 states.
30, 3-0.
Thank you very much. Any questions of these nice people? Any further questions? Anyone?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming on down here.
Thanks.
I hope we get that Maersk port down there in Coos Bay, too, Jeff. That would be a shot in the arm down there.
I'm especially happy if that happens.
Yeah, very good. Okay. I'll entertain a motion, please. Representative Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3339 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 3339 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. If you will indulge me, this is not an easy thing because when you get to strikes and lockouts, they're ugly, emotional, uncomfortable things. I'm going to vote against this bill, but not without a lot of understanding of the issues that go around this. I guess it comes down to this issue of did they vote to strike, and they did vote to strike, and their contracts are the same. So thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Because I'm going to get the last word on this.
I understand.
There will be no one else to have the last word.
I understand.
But me. They are authorizing a strike. They did not vote to go on strike on the other two stores. Only the one store voted to go on strike. Kristen, would you call roll?
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Vice Chair Kimball.
No.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Aye.
Excuse?
Aye. Would anyone like to carry this bill, or should I carry it? Representative Holby, you're fine. I'm acting. Close the work session on House Bill 3339. Open the work session on House Bill 3361.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3361 allows a PERS retiree who's employed by either the Legislative Assembly or the Oregon State Police during any or all of a regular special session to be employed without affecting their status as a retired member. And we have a current subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And folks, all we're doing is moving this to Ways and Means today. We're not even going to have a hearing on it. Would you like to discuss it or not?
I'd kind of like.
Yes, Representative Escobar.
Yes, I kind of would. So this is, let me get this straight. We have a retired person that's on PERS that comes in and works for 6 months at X amount of dollars, and you're trying to carve them out and saying that this would not affect their retirement.
Their hourly limitations.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they're limited to how many hours they can work.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
So
this will remain.
The hour still remains the same, or is it?
It would not affect their status. So essentially, the hourly provision would be removed while they're working during session only. This would not be effective during the interim, just for session only.
It's just staff and state police that work in the Capitol during session. Correct?
Correct.
Any further questions? Representative Holby?
Mr. Chair, didn't we pass something similar to this for a fire district up in Black Butte last session?
Well, boy, you're reaching, possibly.
It's familiar. This stuff's familiar.
Well, I'll entertain a motion to move it to Ways and Means. Representative Rosenbaum.
With the due pass? Or?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'll move House Bill 3361. Be sent to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 3361 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Kristen?
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. I'm going to close work session in House Bill 3361. Anything for the good of the order? Just come to work ready to vote, folks.
You do.
You do. Our turn. And you do it.